All for Finnair Flight 821 to Frankfurt. Would all remaining passengers please board the aircraft? Connor still remained in his place. He must have fallen asleep because the next thing he remembered was waking and finding the pale young man standing at the end of the bed looking down at him.
"We leave for the airport in 20 minutes,
he had told him, and tossed a thick brown package onto the bed. Connor sat up and tore open the envelope. It contained a first-class ticket to Dulles International, $1,000 US, and an American passport. He flicked open the passport and read the name. Christopher Andrew Jackson, above a photograph of himself. He looked up at the young Russian.
What does this mean?
It means you're still alive,
said Alexei Romanov.
This is the final call for Flight 821 for Frankfurt. Would any remaining passengers please take their seats immediately?
Connor strolled across to the gate agent, handed over his boarding pass, and made his way to the waiting plane. The steward checked his seat number and pointed to the front section of the aircraft. Connor didn't have to search for the window seat in the fifth row, because the tall young Russian was already strapped into the aisle seat. It was obviously his job not only to pick up the package, but also to deliver it, and to make sure the contract was carried out. As Connor stepped over his escort's feet, a stewardess asked,
"Can I take your hat, Mr. Jackson?"
"No, thank you." He leaned back in the comfortable seat, but didn't relax until the plane had taken off. Then it began to sink in for the first time that he really had escaped. But to what, he wondered. He glanced to his left. From now on, someone would be with him night and day until he had carried out his side of the bargain. During the flight to Germany, Romanov never once opened his mouth except to eat a few morsels of the meal they put in front of him. Connor left an empty plate and then passed the time by reading Finnair's in-flight magazine. By the time the plane landed in Frankfurt, he knew all about saunas, javelin throwers, and the Finns' dependence on the Russian economy. As they walked into the transit lounge, Connor spotted the CIA agent immediately. He quickly detached himself from his escort, returning 20 minutes later to Romanov's evident relief. Connor knew it would be easy to shake off his minder once they were back on his own territory, but he also knew that if he tried to escape, they would carry out the threat the chief had so vividly described. He shuddered at the thought of any of those thugs laying a finger on Maggie or Tara. The United Airways 777 took off for Dulles on schedule. Connor managed to eat most of the first and second courses of his lunch. The moment the stewardess removed his tray, he pressed the button in his armrest, reclined his seat, and began to think about Maggie. How he envied the fact that she could always... A few moments later, he fell asleep on a plane for the first time in 20 years. When he woke, they were serving a snack. He must have been the only person on the flight to eat everything they put in front of him, including the 2 pots of marmalade. In the final hour before they were due to land in Washington, his thoughts returned to Chris Jackson and the sacrifice he'd made. Connor knew he could never repay him, but he was determined not to let it be a worthless gesture. His mind switched to Dexter and Guttenberg, who must now be assuming he was dead. First they had sent him to Russia to save their own skins. Next they had murdered Joan because she just might have passed some information on to Maggie. How long would it be before they decided Maggie herself had become too great a risk, and that she also needed to be disposed of?
"This is your captain speaking. We have been cleared to land at Dulles International Airport. Would the cabin crew please prepare for landing? On behalf of Delta Airways, I'd like to welcome you to the United States."
Connor flicked open his passport. Christopher Andrew Jackson was back on his home soil. Chapter 25. Maggie arrived at Dulles Airport an hour early, a habit which used to drive Connor mad. She checked the arrival screen and was pleased to see that the flight from San Francisco was scheduled to land on time. She picked up a copy of the Washington Post from the newsstand and wandered into the nearest coffee shop, perched herself on a stool at the counter and ordered a black coffee and a croissant. She didn't notice the two men occupying a table in the opposite corner, one of whom also had a copy of the Washington Post which he appeared to be reading. But however hard she'd looked, she wouldn't have seen the third man, who was taking more interest in her than in the arrival screen he was looking up at. He had already spotted the other two men in the corner. Maggie read the post from cover to cover, checking her watch every few minutes. By the time she'd ordered her second coffee, she was delving into the supplement on Russia, published in anticipation of President Zarembski's forthcoming visit to Washington. Maggie didn't like the sound of the communist leader, who seemed to belong in the last century. She had downed her third coffee 20 minutes before the plane was scheduled to land, so she slipped off the stool and headed for the nearest bank of phones. Two men followed her out of the restaurant while a third slipped from one shadow into another. She dialed a cell phone number. "Good morning, Jackie," she said when her deputy answered. "I'm just checking to see if everything's okay." "Maggie," said a voice, trying not to sound too exasperated, "it's 7 o'clock in the morning, and I am still in bed. You called yesterday, remember? The university is in recess. No one is due back until the 14th of January, and after 13 years of being your deputy, I am just about capable of running the office in your absence." "Sorry, Jackie," said Maggie. "I didn't mean to wake you. I forgot how early it was. I promise not to bother you again." "I hope Connor gets back soon, and that Tara and Stuart keep you fully occupied for the next few weeks," said Jackie. "Have a good Christmas, and I don't want to hear from you again before the end of January," she added with feeling. Maggie put the phone down, realizing she had only been killing time and shouldn't have bothered Jackie in the first place. She chastised herself and decided she wouldn't call her again until the new year. She walked slowly over to the arrivals gate and joined the growing number of people peering through the windows at the runway, where early morning flights were taking off and landing. Three men, who weren't checking the insignia of every aircraft that arrived, continued to watch Maggie as she waited for the board to confirm that United's Flight 50 from San Francisco had landed. When the message finally appeared, she smiled. One of the three men punched 11 numbers into his cell phone and passed the information back to his superior at Langley. Maggie smiled again when a man wearing a 49ers cap emerged from the jetway, the first passenger off the red eye. She had to wait for another 10 minutes before Tara and Stuart came through the door. She had never seen her daughter looking more radiant. The moment Stuart spotted Maggie, he gave her the huge grin that had become so familiar during their holiday in Australia. Maggie hugged them in turn. "It's wonderful to see you both," she said. She took one of Tara's bags and led them towards the subway, which led to the main terminal.
This ends Disc 6. The 11th Commandment, Disc 7.
One of the men who had been watching her was already waiting in the short-term parking lot in the passenger seat of a Toyota Transporter with a load of 11 new cars. The other two were running across the lot. Maggie, Tara, and Stuart stepped into the cold morning air and walked over to Maggie's car.
"Isn't it time you got yourself something more up-to-date than this old scrap heap, Mom?" Tara asked in mock horror. "I was still in high school when you bought it, and it was second-hand then."
"The Toyota is the safest car on the road," said Maggie primly, "as Consumer Reports regularly confirms."
"No 13-year-old car is safe on the road," replied Tara.
"In any case," said Maggie, ignoring her daughter's jibe, "your father thinks we should hold on to it until he begins his new job, when he'll be given a company car." The mention of Connor brought a moment of awkward silence.
"I'm looking forward to seeing your husband again, Mrs. Fitzgerald," said Stuart as he climbed into the back seat.
Maggie didn't say, "and so am I," but satisfied herself with, "So this is your first visit to America?"
"That's right," Stuart replied as Maggie switched on the ignition. "And already I'm not sure I'll ever want to return to Oz."
"We have enough overpaid lawyers in the States already without adding another one from down under,"
said Tara as they waited in line to pay the parking fee. Maggie smiled at her, feeling happier than she had for weeks. When do you have to go home, Stuart? If you feel he's already outstayed his welcome, we could just turn round and take the next flight back, Mom, said Tara. No, I didn't mean that. It's just, I know you do love to plan ahead, said Tara with a laugh. If she could, Stuart, Mom would make students register for Georgetown at conception. Why didn't I think of that? Said Maggie. I'm not expected back at my desk until the 5th of January, said Stuart. I hope you'll be able to tolerate me for that long. She's not going to be given a lot of choice, said Tara, squeezing his hand. Maggie handed a $10 bill to the cashier before pulling out of the parking lot and onto the highway. She glanced in the rearview mirror but didn't notice a nondescript blue Ford about 100 yards behind her, traveling at roughly the same speed. The man in the passenger seat was reporting in to his superior at Langley that the subject had left curbside at 7:43 and was headed in the direction of Washington with the two packages she had picked up. "Did you enjoy San Francisco, Stuart?" "Every moment," he replied. "We're planning to spend a couple more days there on my way back." When Maggie glanced in her rearview mirror again, she saw a Virginia State Patrol car coming up behind her, its lights flashing. "Is he following me, do you think? I certainly wasn't speeding," said Maggie, looking down to check her speedometer. "Mom, this car is practically an antique and should have been towed away years ago. It could be anything from your brake lights to defective tires. Just pull over." Tara looked out the back window. "And when the traffic cop speaks to you, be sure to flash that Irish smile of yours." Maggie pulled over as the blue Ford drove by in the center lane. "Shit," said the driver as he shot past them. Maggie wound down her window as the two policemen stepped out of their patrol car and walked slowly towards them. The first officer smiled and said politely, "May I see your license, ma'am?" "Certainly, officer," said Maggie, returning his smile. She leaned over, opened her bag, and began rummaging around inside as the second patrolman indicated to Stuart that he should also wind down his window. Stuart thought this was an odd request, as he could hardly have been guilty of any traffic offense, but as he wasn't in his own country, he thought it wiser to comply. He wound down the window just as Maggie located her driving license. As she turned to hand it over, the second policeman drew his gun and fired 3 shots into the car. The two of them walked quickly back to their patrol car. While one eased the car into the early morning traffic, the other phoned the man in the passenger seat of the transporter. "A Toyota has broken down and is in need of your immediate assistance." Soon after, the patrol car accelerated away. The transporter, carrying 11 brand-new Toyotas, drew up and stopped in front of the stationary vehicle. The man in the passenger seat, wearing a Toyota cap and blue overalls, leapt out of the cab and ran towards the stationary car. He opened the driver's door, lifted Maggie gently across to the passenger seat, and pulled the lever that opened the car's bonnet, then leaned over to where Stuart was slumped, removed his wallet and passport from his jacket pocket, and replaced them with another passport and a slim paperback book. The driver of the transporter opened the Toyota's bonnet and checked underneath. He swiftly deactivated the tracking device and slammed the bonnet closed. His companion was now seated behind the wheel of the Toyota. He turned on the ignition, put the car into first gear, and slowly drove up the transporter's ramp, taking the one space left. He switched off the ignition, put on the handbrake, fastened the car's wheels to the ramp, and rejoined the driver in the cab. The entire exercise had taken less than 3 minutes. The transporter resumed its journey towards Washington, but after half a mile it took the air freight exit and drove back in the direction of the airport. The CIA officers in the blue Ford had come off the highway at the next exit, then doubled back and rejoined the morning traffic heading into Washington. "She must have committed some minor offense," the driver was saying to his superior at Langley. "It wouldn't be surprising with a car that old." The officer in the passenger seat was surprised to find that the Toyota was no longer registering on his screen. "They're probably on their way back to Georgetown," he suggested. "We'll call in the moment we regain contact."
As the two agents sped towards Washington, the transporter carrying the 12 Toyotas turned left off the Dulles service road to a sign marked Cargo Only. After a few hundred yards, it turned right through a high wire gate held open by two men in airport overalls and drove down an old runway towards an isolated hangar. A lone figure stood at the entrance to guide them in, as if the transporter was a recently landed aircraft. The driver brought the vehicle to a halt next to an unmarked van. Seven men in white overalls quickly emerged from the back. One of them undid the chains that secured the old car to the transporter. Another took his place behind the wheel, released the handbrake, and allowed the Toyota to roll slowly back down the ramp to the ground. The moment it came to a halt, its doors were opened, and the bodies inside were carefully lifted out. The man in the Toyota cap jumped out of the transporter and took the wheel of the old car. He threw it into first gear, swung round in a circle, and shot out of the hangar as if he had been driving it all his life. As he passed through the open gate, the bodies were being gently placed in the rear of the van, where three coffins were waiting for them. One of the men in overalls said, "Don't put the lids on until you're approaching the plane." "Okay, Doc," came the reply. "And once the hold's been closed, remove the bodies and strap them into their seats." As another man nodded, the transporter backed out of the hangar and retraced its route down the old runway and out of the gates. When the driver reached the highway, he turned left and headed towards Leesburg, where he would deliver 11 new Toyotas to the local dealer. His fee for 6 hours unscheduled work would allow him to buy one of them. The wire gate had already been locked and bolted by the time the van drove out of the hangar and began heading slowly towards the cargo docking area. The driver passed rows of cargo planes, finally stopping at the back of a 747 marked Air Transport International. The hold was open, and two customs officials stood waiting at the bottom of the ramp. They began checking the paperwork just as the two CIA officers in the blue Ford drove past 1648 Avon Place. After cautiously circling the block, the agents reported back to Langley that there was no sign either of the car or the three packages. The old Toyota came off Route 66 and joined the highway into Washington. The driver put his foot down hard on the accelerator and sped towards the city. Over his earphone, he listened to the two officers in the Ford being instructed to go to Mrs. Fitzgerald's office to see if the car was in her usual parking space behind the admissions building. Once the customs officials had satisfied themselves that the coroner's documents were in order, one of them said, "Okay, remove the lids." They carefully checked through the clothes and in the mouths and other orifices of all three bodies, then countersigned the documents. The lids were replaced, and the men in white overalls carried the coffins one by one up the ramp and laid them side by side in the hold. The ramp of the 747 was being raised as the old Toyota drove past Christchurch. It sped up the hill for another three blocks before screeching to a halt in the driveway of 1648 Avon Place. The driver had already slipped around the side of the house and let himself in through the back door by the time the doctor began checking the pulses of his three patients. He ran upstairs to the master bedroom and opened the chest of drawers by the side of the bed. He rummaged among his sports shirts, took out the brown envelope marked "Not to be opened before 17th of December," and slipped it into an inside pocket. He pulled down two suitcases from the top of the wardrobe and quickly filled them with clothes. Next, he removed a small cellophane packet from his overalls and slipped it into a cosmetics bag, which he threw into one of the cases. Before he left the bedroom, he switched on the bathroom light, then the light at the bottom of the stairs, and finally, using the remote control, the television in the kitchen, setting the volume to high. He left the suitcases by the back door and returned to the Toyota, raised the bonnet, and reactivated the tracking device. The CIA officers had begun slowly circling the university parking lot for a second time when a blip reappeared on their screen. The driver quickly turned round and headed back towards the Fitzgeralds' home. The man in the Toyota cap returned to the rear of the house, grabbed the suitcases, and let himself out by the back gate. He spotted the taxi parked in front of Tudor Place and jumped into the back just as the two agents returned to Avon Place. A relieved young man called Langley to report that the Toyota was parked in its usual place,
and that he could see and hear a television on in the kitchen. No, he couldn't explain how the tracking device had been out of action for nearly an hour. The taxi driver didn't even turn his head when the man jumped in the back of his cab carrying two suitcases. But then he knew exactly where Mr. Fitzgerald wanted to be taken.
Chapter 26. "Are you telling me that all three of them have disappeared off the face of the earth?" said the director.
"It looks that way," replied Guttenberg. "It was such a professional operation that if I didn't know he was dead, I would have said it had all the hallmarks of Connor Fitzgerald."
"As we know, that's impossible. Who do you think it was?"
"My bet is still Jackson," replied the deputy director.
"Well, if he's back in the country, Mrs. Fitzgerald will know her husband is dead, so we can expect to see her home video on the early evening news any day now."
Guttenberg grinned complacently. "Not a chance," he said, passing a sealed package across the table to his boss. "One of my agents finally found the tape a few minutes before the university library closed last night."
"That's one problem dealt with," said the director, tearing open the package.
"But what's to stop Jackson telling Lloyd who's really buried in the crucifix?" Guttenberg shrugged his shoulders. "Even if he does, what use is the information to Lawrence? He's hardly going to phone up his pal Zarimsky a few days before he's due to arrive in Washington on a goodwill visit to let him know that the man they hanged for planning his assassination wasn't a South African terrorist hired by the mafia after all, but a CIA agent carrying out orders that had come directly from the White House."
"Maybe not," said Dexter. "But as long as Jackson and the Fitzgerald women are out there, we still have a problem. So I suggest you deploy the best dozen agents we've got to track them down and as quickly as possible. I don't care what sector they're working in or who they're assigned to. If Lawrence can prove what really happened in St. Petersburg, he'll have more than enough excuse to call for someone's resignation."
Guttenberg was unusually silent.
"And as it's your signature at the bottom of every relevant document," continued the director, "I would, alas, be left with no choice but to let you go."
Small beads of sweat appeared on Guttenberg's forehead. Stewart thought he was coming out of a bad dream. He tried to recall what had happened. They had been picked up at the airport by Tara's mother, who had been driving them towards Washington, but the car had been stopped by a traffic cop, and he had been asked to wind down his window, and then he looked around. He was on another plane. But where was it going? Tara's head was resting on his shoulder. On her other side was her mother, also fast asleep. All the other seats were empty. He began to go over the facts again, as he always did when preparing for a case. He and Tara had landed at Dulles. Maggie had been waiting for them at the gate. His concentration was broken when a smartly dressed middle-aged man appeared by his side and leaned over to check his pulse.
"Where are we going?"
asked Stewart quietly. But the doctor didn't reply. He carried out the same cursory examination on Tara and Maggie, then disappeared back up to the front of the plane. Stewart unfastened his seatbelt, but hadn't enough strength to stand up. Tara had begun stirring, while Maggie remained resolutely asleep. He checked his pockets. They had taken his wallet and passport. He tried desperately to make some sense of it. Why should anyone go to these extremes for a few $100, some credit cards, and an Australian passport? Even more strangely, they seemed to have replaced them with a slim volume of Yeats's poems. He had never read Yeats before he met Tara, but after she had returned to Stanford, he had begun to enjoy his work. He opened the book at the first poem, A Dialogue of Self and Soul. The words, "I am content to live it all again and yet again," were underlined. He flicked through the pages and noticed that other lines had also been marked. As he was considering the significance of this, a tall, heavily built man appeared by his side, towering menacingly over him. Without a word, he snatched the book from Stewart's hands and returned to the front of the plane. Tara touched his hand. He quickly turned to her and whispered in her ear,
"Say nothing."
She glanced across at her mother, who still hadn't stirred, seemingly at peace with the world. Once Connor had placed the two suitcases in the hold and checked that all three passengers were alive and unharmed, he left the aircraft and climbed into the back of a BMW whose engine was already running.
"We continue to keep our side of the bargain," said Alexei Romanov, who was sitting next to him.
Connor nodded his agreement as the BMW drove out through the wire gates and began its journey to Ronald Reagan National Airport. After his experience at Frankfurt, where the local CIA agent had nearly spotted him because Romanov and his two sidekicks did practically everything except publicly announce their arrival, Connor realized that if he was going to pull off his plan to rescue Maggie and Tara, he would have to run the operation himself. Romanov had finally accepted this when he had been reminded of the clause agreed by his father. Now Connor could only hope that Stuart was as resourceful as he had appeared to be when he had quizzed him on the beach in Australia. He prayed that Stuart would notice the words he'd underlined in the book he'd slipped into his pocket. The BMW drew up outside the upper-level departure entrance of Washington National Airport. Connor stepped out, with Romanov a pace behind. Two other men joined them and followed Connor as he strolled calmly into the airport and over to the ticket counter. He needed them all to relax before he made his next move. When Connor handed over his ticket, the man behind the American Airlines desk said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Radford, but flight 383 to Dallas is running a few minutes late, though we hope to make up the time en route. You'll be boarding at gate 32. Connor walked casually in the direction of the lounge, but stopped when he reached a bank of telephones. He chose one with occupied booths on either side. Romanov and the two bodyguards hovered a few paces away, looking displeased. Connor smiled at them innocently, then slipped Stuart's international phone card into the slot and dialed a Cape Town number. The phone rang for some time before it was eventually answered. "Yes? It's Connor." There was a protracted silence. "I thought it was only Jesus who could rise from the dead," said Carl eventually. "I spent some time in purgatory before I managed it," Connor replied. "Well, at least you're alive, my friend. What can I do for you?" "First, as far as the company is concerned, there will be no second coming." "Understood," said Carl. Connor was answering Carl's last question when he heard the final call for flight 383 to Dallas. He put the phone down, smiled at Romanov again, and headed quickly for gate 32. When Maggie eventually opened her eyes, Stuart leaned across and warned her to say nothing until she was fully awake. A few moments later, a stewardess appeared and asked them to lower their tray tables. An inedible selection of food appeared as if they were on a normal first-class flight. As he contemplated a fish that should have been left in the sea, Stuart whispered to Maggie and Tara, "I haven't a clue why we're here or where we're going, but I have to believe that in some way it's connected with Connor." Maggie nodded and quietly began to tell them everything she had found out since Joan's death. "But I don't think the people holding us can be the CIA," she said, "because I told Guttenberg that if I was missing for more than 7 days, that video would be released to the media." "Unless they've already found it," said Stuart. "That's not possible," said Maggie emphatically. "Then who the hell are they?" said Tara. No one offered an opinion as the stewardess reappeared and silently removed their trays. "Have we got anything else to go on?" Maggie asked after the stewardess had left them. "Only that somebody put a book of Yeats's poems in my pocket," said Stuart. Tara noticed Maggie give a start. "What's the matter?" she asked, looking anxiously at her mother, whose eyes were now filling with tears. "Don't you understand what this means?" "No," said Tara, looking puzzled. "Your father must still be alive. Let me see it," said Maggie. "He might have left a message in it." "I'm afraid I haven't got it anymore. I hardly opened it before a heavy appeared from the front of the plane and snatched it away," said Stuart. "I did notice that a few words were underlined, though."
"What were they?"
asked Maggie urgently.
"I couldn't make much sense of them."
"That doesn't matter. Can you remember any of them?"
Stuart closed his eyes and tried to concentrate.
"Content," he said suddenly.
Maggie smiled.
I am content to live it all again and yet again.
Flight 383 did land in Dallas on time, and when Connor and Romanoff stepped out of the airport, another white BMW was waiting for them. Had the mafia placed a bulk order, Connor wondered? The latest pair of thugs to accompany them looked as if they had been hired from Central Casting. Even their shoulder holsters were bulging under their jackets. He could only hope that the Cape Town branch was a recent subsidiary, although he found it hard to believe that Carl Koter, with over 20 years' experience as the CIA's senior operative in South Africa, wouldn't be able to handle the latest new kid on the block. The trip into downtown Dallas took just over 20 minutes. Connor sat silently in the back of the car, aware that he might be about to come face to face with someone else who had worked for the CIA for almost 30 years. Although they'd never met, he knew this was the biggest risk he had taken since arriving back in America. But if the Russians expected him to honor the most demanding clause in their contract, he had to have the use of the only rifle ideal for carrying out such an assignment. After another silent journey, they pulled up outside Harding's big game emporium. Connor slipped quickly into the shop with Romanoff and his two new shadows dogging his every step. He went up to the counter while they pretended to take a keen interest in a rack of automatic pistols on the far side of the shop. Connor glanced around. His search needed to be quick, unobtrusive, but thorough. After a few moments, he was convinced there were no security cameras in the shop.
"Good afternoon, sir,"
said a young assistant dressed in a long brown coat.
"How can I help you?"
"I'm out here on a shooting trip, and I'd like to buy a rifle. Do you have any particular model in mind?"
"Yes, a Remington 700.
"That should be no problem, sir."
"It may need a few modifications," said Connor.
The assistant hesitated. "Excuse me for a moment, sir." He disappeared through a curtain into a back room. A few moments later, an older man, also dressed in a long brown coat, appeared through the curtain. Connor was annoyed. He had hoped to purchase the rifle without having to meet the legendary Jim Harding.
"Good afternoon," the man said, looking closely at his customer. "I understand you're interested in a Remington 700.
He paused.
"With modifications?"
"Yes, you were recommended by a friend," said Connor.
"Your friend must be a professional," said Harding.
As soon as the word professional was mentioned, Connor knew he was being tested. If Harding hadn't been the Stradivarius of gunsmiths, he would have left the shop without another word.
"What modifications did you have in mind, sir?"
asked Harding, his eyes never leaving the customer's.
Connor described in detail the gun he had left in Bogota, watching carefully for any reaction.
Harding's face remained impassive.
"I might have something that would interest you, sir," he said, then turned and disappeared behind the curtain.
Once again, Connor considered leaving, but within seconds, Harding reappeared, carrying a familiar leather case, which he placed on the counter.
"This model came into our possession after the owner's recent death," he explained.
He flicked up the catches, opened the lid, and swiveled the case round so that Connor could inspect the rifle.
"Every part is handmade, and I doubt if you'll find a finer piece of craftsmanship this side of the Mississippi."
Harding touched the rifle lovingly.
"The stock is fiberglass for lightness and better balance. The barrel is imported from Germany. I'm afraid the Krauts still produce the best. The scope is a Leupold 10 power with mill dots, so you don't even have to adjust for wind.
With this rifle, you could kill a mouse at 400 paces, never mind a moose.
If you're technically minded, you would be capable of a half minute of angle at 100 yards.
He looked up to see if his customer understood what he was talking about, but Connor's expression gave him no clue.
"A Remington 700 with such modifications is only sought after by the most discerning of customers," he concluded.
Connor didn't remove any of the five pieces from their places for fear Mr. Harding would discover just how discerning a customer he was.
"How much?"
he asked, realizing for the first time that he had no idea of the price of a handcrafted Remington 700.
$21,000, Harding said, "though we do have the standard model, should you..."
"No,"
said Connor. This one will be just fine. And how will you be paying, sir? Cash. Then I will require some form of identification, said Harding. I'm afraid there's even more paperwork since they passed the instant ID and registration law to replace the Brady bill. Connor took out a Virginia driver's license he'd bought for $100 from a pickpocket in Washington the previous day. Harding studied the license and nodded. All we need now, Mr. Radford, is for you to fill in these three forms. Connor wrote out the name, address, and social security number of the assistant manager of a shoe store in Richmond. As Harding entered the numbers into a computer, Connor tried to look bored, but he was silently praying that Mr. Radford hadn't reported the loss of his driver's license during the past 24 hours. Suddenly, Harding looked up from the screen. Is that a double-barreled name? He asked. No, replied Connor, not missing a beat. Gregory is my first name. My mother had a thing about Gregory Peck.
Harding smiled. Mine, too.
After a few more moments, Harding said, That all seems to be in order, Mr. Radford.
Connor turned and nodded to Romanoff, who strolled over and extracted a thick bundle of notes from an inside pocket. He spent some time ostentatiously peeling off $100 bills, counting out 210 of them before passing them across to Harding. What Connor had hoped would appear no more than a casual purchase, the Russian was fast turning into a pantomime. The sidekicks might as well have stood out on the street and sold tickets for the performance. Harding wrote out a receipt for the cash and handed it to Connor, who left without another word. One of the hoodlums grabbed the rifle and ran out of the shop onto the sidewalk as if he had just robbed a bank. Connor climbed into the back of the BMW and wondered if it was possible to attract any more attention to themselves. The car screeched away from the curb and cut into the fast-moving traffic, setting off a cacophony of horns. Yes, Connor thought, they obviously could. He remained speechless as the driver broke the speed limit all the way back to the airport. Even Romanoff began to look a little apprehensive. Connor was quickly discovering that the new mafia in the States were still amateurish compared with their cousins from Italy. But it wouldn't be long before they caught up. And when they did, God help the FBI. 15 minutes later, the BMW drew up outside the entrance to the airport. Connor stepped out and began walking towards the revolving door as Romanoff gave instructions to the two men in the car, finally peeling off several more $100 bills and handing them over. When he joined Connor at the check-in counter, he whispered confidentially,
The rifle will be in Washington within 48 hours.
I wouldn't bet on it, said Connor as they headed towards the departure lounge.
You know the whole of Yates off by heart? Asked Stewart in disbelief.
Most of it, admitted Maggie, but then I do reread a few poems almost every night before going to bed.
Darling Stewart, you've still got so much to learn about the Irish, said Tara. Now try to remember some more of the words.
Stewart thought for a moment.
Hollow, he said triumphantly.
Through hollow lands and hilly lands? Asked Maggie.
That's it.
So it can't be Holland we're headed for, said Tara.
Stop being facetious, said Stewart.
Then try to remember some more words, said Tara.
Stewart began to concentrate once again.
Friend, he said eventually. Always we'd have the new friend meet the old, said Maggie.
So we're about to meet a new friend in a new country, said Tara.
But who?
And where?
Said Maggie, as the plane continued its journey through the night. Chapter 27. Within moments of reading the priority message, Guttenberg was dialing the number in Dallas. When Harding came on the line, the deputy director of the CIA simply said, Describe him.
6 foot, possibly 6'1". He was wearing a hat, so I couldn't see his hair color.
Age?
50, could be a year or two either way.
Eyes? Blue.
Dress? Sports jacket, khaki pants, blue shirt, penny loafers, no tie. Smart, but casual. I assumed he was one of ours until I noticed that he was accompanied by a couple of well-known local hoodlums who he tried to pretend weren't with him. There was also a tall young man who never once opened his mouth, but he was the one who paid for the gun. In cash. And the first man made it clear he wanted those particular modifications. Yes, I'm pretty sure he knew exactly what he was looking for. Right. Hold on to the cash. We may be able to identify a fingerprint from one of the bills. You won't find any of his prints on them, said Harding. The young man paid, and one of the hoodlums carried the gun out of the shop.
Whoever it was obviously wasn't willing to risk taking it through airport security, said Guttenberg.
The two thugs must simply have been couriers. What name did he sign the forms in? Gregory Peck Radford.
Identification?
Virginia driver's license. The address and date of birth all tied in with the correct social security number.
I'll have an agent with you in under an hour. He can start by emailing me any details you have on the two hoodlums, and I'll need a police artist's computerized sketch of the main suspect.
That won't be necessary, said Harding.
Why not?
Because the whole transaction was recorded on video.
Guttenberg couldn't see Harding's smile of satisfaction as he added,
Even you wouldn't have spotted the security camera.
Stewart continued to concentrate.
Find out, he said suddenly.
I will find out where she has gone, said Maggie with a smile. We're going to meet a new friend in a new country, and he'll find us, said Tara. Can you remember anything else, Stewart?
All things fall
and are built again, Maggie whispered as the man who had snatched the book out of Stewart's hands reappeared by their side.
Now listen, and listen carefully, he said, looking down at them. If you hope to survive, and I don't give a damn either way, you will follow my instructions to the letter. Is that understood?
Stewart stared into the man's eyes and didn't doubt that he looked upon the three of them as just another job. He nodded.
Right, the man continued. When the plane lands, you will go directly to the baggage area, pick up your luggage, and pass through customs without attracting any attention to yourselves. You will not, I repeat, not use the restrooms. Once you're through customs and in the arrivals area, you'll be met by two of my men, who will accompany you to the house where you'll be staying for the foreseeable future. I will meet up with you again later this evening. Is that clear?
Yes, said Stewart firmly, on behalf of the three of them.
If any of you is stupid enough to make a run for it, or tries to enlist any help, Mrs. Fitzgerald will be killed immediately. And if she's not available for any reason, I get to choose between you two.
He looked at Tara and Stewart.
Those were the terms. Mr. Fitzgerald agreed.
That's not possible, began Maggie. Connor would never...
I think it might be wise, Mrs. Fitzgerald, to allow Mr. Farnham to speak on behalf of all of you in the future, said the man.
Maggie would have corrected him if Tara hadn't quickly kicked her leg.
You'll need these, he said, handing over three passports to Stewart.
He checked them and passed one to Maggie and another to Tara as the man returned to the cockpit. Stewart looked down at the remaining passport, which, like the other two, bore the American Eagle on its cover. When he flicked it open, he found his own photograph above the name Daniel Farnham, profession University Law Professor, address 75 Marina Boulevard, San Francisco, California. He passed it across to Tara, who looked puzzled.
I do like dealing with professionals, said Stewart, and I'm beginning to realize that your father is one of the best.
Are you sure you can't remember any more words? Asked Maggie.
I'm afraid not, said Stewart.
No, wait a moment. Anarchy! Maggie smiled.
Now I know where we're going.
It's a long drive from Dallas to Washington. The two thugs who had dropped Connor and Romanoff off at the airport had always planned to break the journey somewhere before continuing to the capital the following day. Just after 9 o'clock that evening, having covered around 400 miles, they pulled into a motel on the outskirts of Memphis. The two senior CIA officers who watched them park their BMW reported back to Guttenberg 45 minutes later. They've checked into the Memphis Marriott, rooms 107 and 108,
They ordered room service at 9:33 and are currently in room 107 watching Nash Bridges.
Where's the rifle? Asked Guttenberg.
It's handcuffed to the wrist of the man booked into room 108.
Then you're going to need a waiter and a passkey, said Guttenberg.
Just after 10 o'clock, a waiter appeared in room 107 and set up a table for dinner. He opened a bottle of red wine, poured two glasses, and laid out the food. He told the guests he would return in about 40 minutes to clear the table. One of them told him to cut up his steak into little pieces, as he only had the use of one hand. The waiter was happy to oblige.
Enjoy, he added as he left the room.
The waiter then went straight to the car park and reported to the senior officer, who thanked him, then made a further request. The waiter nodded, and the agent handed him a $50 bill.
Obviously not willing to let go of it even when he's eating, said the other agent once the waiter was out of earshot.
The waiter returned to the car park a few minutes after midnight to report that both men had gone to bed in their own rooms. He handed over a passkey, and in return was given another $50 bill. He'd left, feeling he'd done a good night's work. What he didn't know was that the man in room 107 had taken the keys of the handcuffs so as to be sure that no one would try and steal the briefcase from his partner while he was asleep. When the guest in 107 woke the following morning, he felt unusually drowsy. He checked his watch and was surprised to find out how late it was. He pulled on his jeans and hurried through the connecting door to wake his partner. He came to a sudden halt, fell on his knees, and began to vomit. Lying on the carpet in a pool of blood was a severed hand. As they stepped off the plane in Cape Town, Stewart was aware of the presence of two men watching their every move. An immigration officer stamped their passports, and they headed towards the baggage claim area. After only a few minutes, luggage began to appear on the carousel. Maggie was surprised to see two of her old suitcases coming down the chute. Stewart was starting to get used to the way Connor Fitzgerald operated. Once they had retrieved their bags, Stewart put them all on a trolley, and they walked towards the green customs exit. The two men filed in close behind them. As Stewart was wheeling the trolley through customs, an officer stepped into his path, pointed to the red suitcase, and asked if the owner would place it on the counter. Stewart helped Maggie lift it as the two men following them reluctantly moved on. Once they had passed through the sliding doors, they stationed themselves a few feet from the exit. Each time the doors opened, they could be seen peering back through. Within moments, they were joined by two other men.
"Would you open the case, please, ma'am?" asked the customs officer.
Maggie flicked up the catches and smiled at the mess that greeted her. Only one person could have packed that case. The customs officer dug around among her clothes for a few moments and eventually came out with a cosmetics bag. He unzipped it and removed a small cellophane packet which contained a white powdery substance.
"But that isn't..." began Maggie.
This time it was Stewart who restrained her.
"I'm afraid we'll have to conduct a body search, ma'am," said the officer. "Perhaps in the circumstances your daughter would like to join you."
Stewart wondered how the officer could possibly have known that Tara was Maggie's daughter when he apparently didn't assume that he was her son.
"Would all three of you care to follow me?" said the officer. "Please bring the case and the rest of your luggage."
He lifted a section of the counter and ushered them through a door that led into a small drab room with a table and two chairs.
"One of my colleagues will join you in a moment," he said.
He closed the door and they heard the key turning in the lock.
"What's going on?" said Maggie. "That bag wasn't..."
"I expect we're about to find out," said Stewart.
A door on the far side of the room opened, and a tall, athletic-looking man who didn't have a hair on his head, although he couldn't have been a day over 50, bounced into the room. He was dressed in blue jeans and a red sweater and certainly didn't give the impression of being a customs officer. He went straight over to Maggie, took her right hand, and kissed it.
"My name is Carl Kother," he said in a broad South African accent. "This is a great honor for me, Mrs. Fitzgerald. I've wanted for many years to meet the woman who was brave enough to marry Connor Fitzgerald. He called me yesterday afternoon and asked me to assure you that he's very much alive."
Maggie would have said something, but the flow didn't stop. Of course, I know far more about you than you do about me, but unhappily on this occasion we will not have time to remedy that. He smiled at Stuart and Tara and bowed slightly. Perhaps you would all be kind enough to follow me. He turned and began to push the trolley through the door. Always we'd have the new friend meet the old, Maggie whispered. Stuart smiled. The South African led them down a steep ramp and along a dark, empty passageway. Maggie quickly caught up with him and immediately began to question him about his phone conversation with Connor. At the end of the tunnel, they climbed up another ramp and emerged on the far side of the airport. Kurter guided them quickly through security, where they were met with only the most cursory of checks. After another long trek, they arrived in an empty departure lounge, where Kurter handed over 3 tickets to a gate agent and received 3 boarding passes for a Qantas flight to Sydney that had been mysteriously held up for 15 minutes. "How can we begin to thank you?" asked Maggie. Kurter took her hand and kissed it again. "Ma'am," he replied, "you will find people all over the world who will never be able to fully repay Connor Fitzgerald." They both sat watching the television. Neither of them spoke until the 12-minute clip had come to an end. "Could it be possible?" said the director quietly. "Only if he somehow changed places with him in the crucifix," replied Guttenberg. Dexter was silent for some time before she said, "Jackson would only have done that if he was willing to sacrifice his own life." Guttenberg nodded. "And who's the man who paid for the rifle?" "Alexei Romanov, the son of the Tsar and the number 2 in the Russian mafia. One of our agents spotted him at Frankfurt Airport, and we suspect he and Fitzgerald are now working together." "So it must have been the mafia who got him out of the crucifix," said Dexter. "But if he needed a Remington 700, who's the target?" "The president," said Guttenberg. "You could be right," replied Dexter. "But which one?" Chapter 28. The President of the United States and the Secretary of State were among the 72 officials lined up on the runway when the Russian Air Force Ilyushin 62 landed at Andrews Air Force Base just outside Washington, D.C. The red carpet had already been rolled out, a podium with a dozen microphones was in place, and a wide staircase was being towed towards the exact spot on the tarmac where the aircraft would taxi to a standstill. As the door of the plane opened, Tom Lawrence shielded his eyes from the bright morning sun. A tall, slim stewardess was standing in the doorway. A moment later, a short, squat man appeared next to her. Although Lawrence knew that Zerimsky was only 5'4", standing next to the tall stewardess cruelly emphasized his lack of stature. Lawrence doubted if it would be possible for a man of Zerimsky's height to become President of the United States. As Zerimsky slowly descended the steps, the massed ranks of photographers began clicking furiously. From behind their cordon, camera crews from every network focused on the man who would dominate the world's news for the next 4 days. The U.S. Chief of Protocol stepped forward to introduce the 2 presidents, and Lawrence shook hands warmly with his guest. "Welcome to the United States, Mr. President."
"Thank you, Tom," said Zerimsky, immediately wrong-footing him.
Lawrence turned to present the Secretary of State.
"Nice to meet you, Larry," said Zerimsky.
Zerimsky appeared disarmingly affable and friendly as he was introduced to each new official, the Defense Secretary, the Commerce Secretary, the National Security Advisor. When he came to the end of the line, Lawrence touched his elbow and guided him towards the podium. As they walked across the runway, the American president leaned down and said, "I'll just say a few words of welcome, Mr. President, and then perhaps you'd like to reply."
"Victor, please,"
Zerimsky insisted. Lawrence stepped up onto the podium, extracted a single sheet of paper from an inside pocket, and placed it on the lectern.
"Mr. President," he began.
Then, turning toward Zerimsky, he smiled and said,
"Victor, may I begin by welcoming you to America?" Today marks the opening of a new era in the special relationship between our two great countries. Your visit to the United States heralds...
Connor sat in front of three television screens watching the major network's coverage of the ceremony. That night he would replay the tapes again and again. There was an even greater security presence on the ground than he had anticipated. The Secret Service seemed to have turned out a full dignitary protective division for each president. But there was no sign of Guttenberg or of any CIA operatives. Connor suspected that the Secret Service was unaware that a potential assassin was on the loose. Connor wasn't at all surprised that the rifle he had bought in Dallas had never reached its destination. The two mafia hoodlums had done everything to tip off the CIA except call them on their toll-free number. Had he been deputy director, Connor would have allowed them to deliver the rifle in the hope that they would lead him to the person who intended to use it. Guttenberg had obviously considered that removing the weapon was more important. Perhaps he was right. Connor couldn't risk being put through another debacle like the one in Dallas. They had made it necessary for him to come up with an alternative plan. After the episode in the Memphis Marriott, it had become clear that Alexei Romanov wasn't willing to take the blame if anything else went wrong, and Connor now had overall control of the preparations for the assassination. Those shadowing him kept a respectful distance, although they never let him out of their sight, otherwise he would have been at Andrews Air Force Base that morning. Although he could still have shaken them off whenever he chose, Connor was made aware of their attitude to failure when he learned that the local mafia boss in Dallas had chopped off the hoodlum's other hand so that he couldn't make the same mistake twice. The president came to the end of his welcoming speech and received a round of applause that had little impact in such a large open space. He stepped aside to allow Zarimsky to respond. But when the Russian president took his place, he couldn't be seen above the bank of microphones. Connor knew that the press would remind the 6-foot-1 American president of this public relations disaster again and again over the next 4 days, and that Zarimsky would assume it had been done intentionally to upstage him. He wondered which White House advance man's head would roll later that day. Shooting a 6-foot man would be much easier than one who was only 5-foot-4, Connor reflected. He studied the agents from the Dignitary Protective Division who had been assigned to protect Zarimsky during his visit. He recognized 4 of them, all of whom were as good as any in their profession. Any one of them could have brought a man down with a single shot at 300 paces and disarmed an attacker with 1 blow. Behind their dark glasses, Connor knew that their eyes were darting ceaselessly in every direction. Although Zarimsky couldn't be seen by those standing on the runway, his words could be heard clearly. Connor was surprised to find that the hectoring, bullying manner he had employed in Moscow and St. Petersburg had been replaced by a far more conciliatory tone. He thanked Tom for his warm welcome and said that he was confident the visit would prove fruitful for both nations. Connor was sure that Lawrence wouldn't be fooled by this outward display of warmth. This obviously wasn't the time or place for the Russian president to allow the Americans to discover his real agenda. As Zarimsky continued to read from his script, Connor glanced down at the 4-day itinerary prepared by the White House and so conveniently catalogued minute by minute in the Washington Post. He knew from years of experience that even with the best-laid plans, such programs rarely managed to keep to their original timetables. At some time during the visit, he had to assume that the unexpected would happen, and he had to be sure that it wasn't at the moment when he was lining up his rifle. The two presidents would be flown by helicopter from the Air Force Base to the White House, where they would immediately go into a session of private talks, which would continue over lunch. After lunch, Zarimsky would be taken to the Russian embassy to rest before returning to the White House in the evening for a black-tie dinner in his honor. The following morning, he would travel to New York to address the United Nations and have lunch with the Secretary General, followed by a visit to the Metropolitan Museum in the afternoon. Connor had laughed out loud when he read that morning in the style section of the Post that Tom Lawrence had become aware of his guest's great love of the arts during the recent presidential campaign, in the course of which Zarimsky had found time in his busy schedule to visit not only the Bolshoi, but also the Pushkin and the Hermitage museums.
After the Russian president returned to Washington on Thursday night, he would have just enough time to rush to the embassy and change into a dinner jacket before attending a performance of Swan Lake by the Washington Ballet at the Kennedy Center. The Post tactlessly reminded its readers that over half the corps de ballet were Russian immigrants. On the Friday morning, there would be extended talks at the White House, followed by lunch at the State Department. In the afternoon, Zarimsky would deliver an address to a joint session of Congress, which would be the high point of his four-day visit. Lawrence hoped that the legislators would be convinced that the Russian leader was a man of peace and agree to back his arms reduction bill. An editorial in the New York Times warned that this might be the occasion at which Zarimsky would outline Russia's defense strategy for the next decade. The paper's diplomatic correspondent had contacted the press office at the Russian embassy, only to be informed curtly that there would be no advanced copies of that particular speech. In the evening, Zarimsky would be the guest of honor at a U.S.-Russia Business Council dinner. Copies of that speech had already been widely circulated, with a casual indifference to any embargo. Connor had been through every sentence and knew that no self-respecting journalist would bother to print a word of it. On the Saturday, Zarimsky and Tom Lawrence would go to Cook Stadium in Maryland to watch the football game between the Washington Redskins and the Green Bay Packers, the team that Lawrence, who had been the senior senator for Wisconsin, had supported all his life. In the evening, Zarimsky would host a dinner at the Russian embassy to return the hospitality of all those whose guests he had been during his visit. The following morning, he would fly back to Moscow, but only if Connor had failed to carry out the contract. 9 venues for Connor to consider, but he had already dismissed 7 of them before Zarimsky's plane had touched down. Of the remaining 2, the banquet on the Saturday night looked the most promising, especially after he'd been told by Romanov that the Mafia had the catering concession for all functions held at the Russian embassy. A smattering of applause brought Connor's attention back to the welcoming ceremony. Some of the people standing on the runway were unaware that Zarimsky had completed his speech until he stepped down from the podium, so the reception he received was not quite as enthusiastic as Lawrence had hoped. The 2 leaders walked across the tarmac to a waiting helicopter. Normally, no Russian president would fly in a U.S. military aircraft, but Zarimsky had brushed aside any objections, telling his advisers he wanted to take every opportunity of wrong-footing Lawrence. They climbed on board and waved to the crowd. Moments later, Marine One rose, hovered above the ground for a few seconds, then lifted away. Those women who had not attended a welcoming ceremony before were unsure whether to cling on to their hats or hold down their dresses. In 7 minutes, Marine One would land on the south lawn of the White House to be met by Andy Lloyd and the White House senior staff. Connor flicked off the 3 televisions, rewound the tapes, and began considering the alternatives. He had already decided not to go to New York. The United Nations and the Metropolitan Museum offered virtually no possibility of escape, and he was aware that the Secret Service were trained to spot anyone who appeared on more than one occasion during a visit such as this one, including journalists and television crews. Added to that, at least 3,000 of New York's finest would be guarding Zarimsky every second of his visit. He would use the time, while Zarimsky was out of town, to check out the 2 most promising venues. The Mafia had already arranged for him to be a member of the catering team that would visit the Russian embassy that afternoon, so he could be taken through the details of Saturday night's banquet. The ambassador had made it clear that he wanted it to be an occasion that neither president would ever forget. Connor checked his watch, put on a coat, and went downstairs. The BMW was waiting for him. He climbed into the back seat. Cook Stadium, was all he said. No one in the car commented as the driver eased the car into the center lane. As a transporter laden with new cars passed on the other side of the road, Connor thought of Maggie and smiled. He had spoken to Carl Coder earlier that morning and had been reassured that all 3 of the kangaroos were safely in their pouches. By the way, the Mafia are under the impression that they were sent straight back to America, Coder had told him. How did you manage to pull that one off? Asked Connor. One of their guards tried to bribe a customs officer.
He took the money and informed him they'd been caught with drugs and had been returned to their port of embarkation.
Do you think they fell for it?
Oh, yes, said Cotter. They were made to pay a lot of money for that piece of information.
Connor laughed. I'll always be in your debt, Carl. Just let me know how I can repay you.
That won't be necessary, my friend, Cotter had replied. I will simply look forward to meeting your wife again in more agreeable circumstances.
Connor's watchdogs had made no mention of Maggie's disappearance, so he couldn't be certain whether they were too proud to admit that they'd lost her, Stuart and Tara, or whether they were still hoping to catch up with him before he found out the truth. Perhaps they were afraid he wouldn't carry out the job if he knew his wife and daughter were no longer in their hands. But Connor never doubted that if he failed to honor the agreement, Alexei Romanov would eventually track down Maggie and kill her, and if not Maggie, Tara. Volchenkov had warned him that until the contract had been completed, one way or the other, Romanov wouldn't be allowed to return to his homeland.
As the driver swung onto the beltway, Connor thought about Joan, whose only crime was to have been his secretary. He clenched his fist and wished that his contract with the Mafia had been to take out Dexter and her conniving deputy. That was an assignment he would have carried out with relish. The BMW passed the Washington city limits, and Connor sat back, thinking about just how much preparation still needed to be done. He would have to circle the stadium several times, checking every exit before deciding if he would even enter it.
Marine One landed gently on the south lawn. The two presidents stepped out of the helicopter and were greeted by warm applause from the 600 assembled White House members of staff. When Lawrence introduced Zerinsky to his chief of staff, he couldn't help noticing that Andy seemed preoccupied. The two leaders spent an unusually long time posing for the photographers before retiring to the Oval Office with their advisors to confirm the subjects that would be covered at the later meetings. Zerinsky put forward no objections to the timetable Andy Lloyd had prepared and seemed relaxed about the topics that would come under consideration. When they broke for lunch, Lawrence felt the preliminary discussions had gone well. They moved into the cabinet room, and Lawrence told the story of when President Kennedy had dined there with 8 Nobel laureates and had remarked that it was the greatest gathering of intellect there since Jefferson had dined alone. Larry Harrington laughed dutifully, although he had heard the president tell the story 12 times before. Andy Lloyd didn't even attempt a smile. After lunch, Lawrence accompanied Zerinsky to his limousine, which was waiting at the diplomatic entrance. As soon as the last car of the motorcade was out of sight, once again Zerinsky had insisted he should have one more vehicle than any past Russian president, Lawrence hurried back to the Oval Office. A grim-faced Andy Lloyd was standing by his desk.
"I thought that went as well as could be expected," said the president.
"Possibly," said Lloyd, although I wouldn't trust that man to tell the truth even to himself. He was far too cooperative for my liking. I just get the feeling that we're being set up.
Was that the reason you were so uncommunicative during lunch?
No, I think we've got a far bigger problem on our hands, said Lloyd. Have you seen Dexter's latest report? I left it on your desk yesterday afternoon.
No, I haven't, the president replied. I spent most of yesterday holed up with Larry Harrington in the State Department.
He flicked open a file bearing the CIA emblem and began reading. He had sworn out loud on 3 occasions before he had reached the second page. By the time he'd come to the final paragraph, his face was drained of color. He looked up at his oldest friend. I thought Jackson was supposed to be on our side.
He is, Mr. President.
Then how come Dexter claims she can prove that he was responsible for the assassination in Colombia, then went to St. Petersburg intending to kill Zerinsky?
Because that way she clears herself of any involvement and leaves us to explain why we hired Jackson in the first place. By now she'll have a cabinet full of files to prove that it was Jackson who killed Guzman and anything else she wants the world to believe about him. Just look at these pictures she supplied of Jackson in a Bogota bar handing money over to the chief of police. What they don't show is that the meeting took place almost 2 weeks after the assassination. Never forget, sir, that the CIA are unrivaled when it comes to covering their asses.
It's not their asses I'm worried about, said the president.
What about Dexter's story that Jackson's back in America and is working with the Russian mafia?
Isn't that convenient, said Lloyd. If anything goes wrong during Zarimsky's visit, she already has someone lined up to take the rap.
Then how do you explain the fact that Jackson was recorded by a security camera in Dallas a few days ago buying a high-powered rifle of near-identical specifications to the one used to kill Guzman?
Simple, said Lloyd. Once you realize it wasn't actually Jackson, everything else falls into place.
If it wasn't Jackson, then who the hell was it?
It was Connor Fitzgerald, said Lloyd quietly.
But you told me Fitzgerald was arrested in St. Petersburg and then hanged. We'd even discussed how we might get him out.
I know, sir. But that was never going to be a possibility once Zarimsky had been elected. Unless Jackson took his place.
Why on earth would he do that?
Remember that Fitzgerald saved Jackson's life in Vietnam and has the Medal of Honor to prove it. When Fitzgerald returned from the war, it was Jackson who recruited him as an NOC. For the next 28 years, he served the CIA and gained the reputation of being their most respected officer. Then overnight, he disappears and can't be traced on their books. His secretary, Joan Bennett, who worked for him for 19 years, suddenly dies in a mysterious car accident while she's on the way to see Fitzgerald's wife. Then his wife and daughter also vanish off the face of the earth. Meanwhile, the man we appoint to find out what's going on is accused of being an assassin and double-crossing his closest friend. But however carefully you search through Helen Dexter's